importance of the stream and the...
Yeah, so he told us climax, forest, bottomland, hardwood, and we said, well, sure, we know that it's kind of peaceful down there, and there are big trees. Uh-huh. But then he told us that environments like that were quite scarce here in the Piedmont, because they were all going for development, for mm-hmm. lakes. And so that ours was particularly nice, and he reeled off some of the species of both plants and animals that were down there that were not quite on the rare and endangered species list, but some of them were nevertheless quite scarce. And so we came to think of that as indeed a good community resource, even though I imagine you could ask the average person around here when's the last time they went down there and walked or fished or anything, and it might have been years. Mm-hmm. But somehow knowing it's there whenever you want to go down there was a good feeling. Mm-hmm. So I guess you could say that our consciousness was raised as we got more and more into this. And I had a childhood friend from Chapel Hill who got into sociology, and after that got into social impact analysis, and he began to point out various things that that might be consequences of the reservoir. And he really did a lot of consciousness raising, things that we had taken for granted, so much so that we hadn't even thought about them, suddenly became issues of concern.
Such as? What would be
some? Oh, just the way people interact together, some of the community activities that go on, say at the church or at the ball field, the volunteer fire company, and community ties. All of these things that we take sort of for granted, we could begin to see were rather at risk.
Mm-hmm. Because, can you kind of...
Well, for example, if regulations are put on farming, if land values go up, and a few other ifs, then it might put the big dairy farms at the ragged edge of being economically viable. Mm-hmm. And, well, for example, supposing some old widow woman who owned 150 acres that she was renting out to a farmer at, $10 an acre, mm-hmm. making $1,500 from it a year. Supposing that her land rose in value because it was near the reservoir to the point where she could sell it to a developer and make enough money so that the interest from that money would be more than $1,500 a year,
right.
Then it would be to her advantage to sell it. And the consequences of that ramify. Well, for one thing, the farmer now has 150 acres less land, mm-hmm. and that puts a strain on him. And we now have 150 acres that instead of being growing a corn crop or is now cut up into, maybe 2-acre lots, 75 houses there. Increases the traffic and increases the amount, the number of essentially town-oriented people who are now living out in the country. Mm-hmm. Consequences flow from that. One consequence that we know about is that people who move out in the country and, say, build next to a field where crops are grown are not nearly as tolerant of some of the things that farmers do as country people. For instance, farmers, especially dairy farmers, are going to spread on their fields a few times a year the manure that accumulates. And so for a few days, you're going to get a kind of a manure smell. Doesn't smell too bad to a farmer, but maybe to a person who's just moved out from town, it's kind of horrible. And country folks know that you'll have that for a day or two, and there might be some flies buzzing around because of it, and then it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't worry too much about it. We don't worry too much about the tractors that lumber along on the roads
mm-hmm.
at 10 miles an hour. We're sort of patient with that. Patient with a lot of things that farmers just have to do that are occasionally a little bit annoying to the rest of the folks. But the person who moves out may not like this kind of thing at all, and they can institute lawsuits against the farmers. And a couple have been instituted in the neighborhood over the years.
In this neighborhood, right around
here. There was one guy who moved out and built his house next to a hog operation.
Oh.
Now, hog operations can smell.
I haven't been good friend in Clay County was right next to a hog operation.
And the hog operator was sued because of the smells.
Huh.
And I think in another case, there was some runoff getting into a creek that went in back of a newcomer's house. And he sued. So these things can be, quite discouraging to a farmer.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, I'm interested also in the organization itself of the CCCA. One thing that I think struck a lot of people is how, in many ways, it just resembled a community organization, like a church. Thing, where you would have your events and people would come and cook and do kind of the things that they always do when fundraising events are held and that sort of thing. And I'm kind of interested in seeing what you would say, what about the CCCA was very much like a typical community organization to do something, and what was different about it in terms of organization and how it operated. Or the volunteer fire department or something like that.
Well, I guess at that time, in 1976, there were perhaps three community organizations, the biggest being Cane Creek Baptist Church, to which many people in the community belong. Another one being the community building. It is not really an organization. It's a few acres of land with a community building that the community donated the labor and money to build, and then donated the money and labor to manage and keep going. And then the volunteer fire company, which was quite young at that time, and had begun a couple of years before with some fundraising efforts. We'd put on ham and egg supper, and the word would go out through the county, and people would just come flocking in, and we'd sell them all they could eat, ham and eggs.
Well, just for a second, the volunteer program, was that initiated by newcomers to the community?
No,
was
that
it more
was...
Was like a state program that offered money for...
That... As far as I know, that was initiated by some community leaders
mm-hmm.
who had come together informally and had gotten a charter.
Mm-hmm.
And so it existed as a paper organization, I think as early as 74, and probably the impetus for it was the fact that there were one or two others in the county out in the rural areas at that time. plus maybe there had been a fire. I don't know what the impetus was, but anyway, it had started. Yeah, so there were several models of how people get together to do things: the uh-huh. church, the fire company, and the community building. And I guess it was just natural that CCCA sort of evolved along that line. Mm-hmm. Like all these others, we had a need for money, and the only way we knew how to raise money was to, say, put on some suppers or do something in town, bake cakes and sell them in town, or we developed the idea of Farm City Day, where we would publicize the event in Chapel Hill and hope to get Chapel Hillians to come out and take a look at the countryside and see what's here. And we were fairly successful at that, and in fact the whole effort of coming together to try to put one of these events on was a process that sort of bound us together. And we found that we were attracting the interest of people who lived out here who before that had not felt a part of the community. There were a bunch of 1960s style counterculture folks, sort of a get away from it all folks, back to the land folks, scattered around, and they were quite sympathetic to our efforts, and they came in and found that they liked these folks out here, and the old folks kind of thought they were neat too. So mm-hmm. that brought together then that crew, and the people like me who had moved out of town fairly recently, and the old timers mm-hmm. all came together.
Mm-hmm. More so, would you say, than at the volunteer fire department or the community?
Yeah. The counterculture types, I think, never would have presented themselves to the Cane Creek Baptist Church for membership. That was one of the things they were probably rebelling against in the first place. Volunteer Fire Company attracts a number of newcomers, but that's fairly specialized, and that requires one's volunteering a good chunk of his time mm-hmm. for training and for going out at 3 a.m. on fire calls and so mm-hmm. on. So you don't get everybody showing up that wants to do that.
And would you say, is that mostly an organization of men as well? Or?
Mostly. Mm-hmm. Although when we organized it, we wrote the rules to be gender free. Mm-hmm. Because we knew that the day might come when we'd have to go out and try to pull some women in to volunteer for us, and we have been somewhat successful in more recent years.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that interests me in terms of this developing your feelings about the community and about the whole situation, I guess, is obviously a big element in that is the fact that these were people coming from Chapel Hill out here, and people didn't like that.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm wondering, when you were working in the organization, was there evidence of an ongoing kind of hostility toward Chapel Hill that people had felt maybe in the past that they had problems with Chapel Hill, or in the past had problems with outsiders, that it was necessary to fight them off or something like that? Was there that kind of historical sense to it, or had people more or less everything had been fine and people had been left alone until now?
Well, I think that the rural parts of the county have always had a bit of suspicion about Chapel Hill. Now it's more true as you get into the northern part of the county. Down here in the southwestern half, I think it's more bordering on a love-hate relationship. There are some things that happen in Chapel Hill that people out here can be quite proud of.
Such as?
Oh, I think that some of the folks out here have, say, given their allegiance to some of the sports teams. Some of them for Carolina, some of them for state.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at the Snipes Dairy Farm and see what it's called. It's called Annalorac. Annalorac Farm, and if you spell that backwards, it's Carolina. And it turns out that the Snipes, although I think they never attended UNC as students, they're big Tar Heel fans. Mm-hmm. They go to the football games and the basketball games. So there is a kind of a respect for the university and Chapel Hill, and at the same time there is some apprehension. It's kind of like, I think, as Sam Crawford put it once, it's like being next to a sleeping giant. You're always kind of afraid it's going to roll over in the night and crush you. And so we thought that this wanting more water was like the big giant rolling over in the night, and they were going to make us give them our water.
Well, and also in just in terms of, again, sort of, I'm kind of interested in, we talk about how this fits into the sort of historical context of the whole development of this area, and in, again, people feeling maybe that they are kind of, that they do kind of need to fight or oppose to other aspects in the county. You go back to the Civil War, and I guess this area voted against the Civil War in enormous numbers, that sort of thing. And if there's, I'm just wondering if that there's sort of a sense of being opposed to things that are going on in terms of historically, like, you know, my granddad had to fight off something or other. I mean, maybe that's, I mean, that very well may not be there. I'm just interested as whether in the context of this organization, people had a sense that they were carrying on any kind of a tradition in terms of being protesting or not.
I don't believe I ever heard that sentiment, that this is just one more battle in a long series. No, I don't recall anybody bringing up anything from 50 or 100 years ago.
Okay.
And it may be that, indeed, Chapel Hill and the university 50 and 100 years ago played really a minor role in county affairs.
Right.
If you look at who sat on the county commissioner board, for example, historically it's been county people.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you get to maybe the 1950s or 60s that you began to see that Chapel Hill has grown to the point where they can elect Chapel Hillians to that board.
Right.
And so a lot of the resentments go back just about that far.
So you felt that going back to the 50s, that there have been these kind of resentments?
Perhaps, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Another thing that I'm interested in is in terms of sort of the momentum of CCCA, how that changed. My impression is, of course, there was a big, people were very interested at the beginning, and they were angry, and that sort of contributed to a lot of interest in the organization and energy for it. And then, of course, it lasted 10 years, I guess, in various landmarks, such as the EMC hearings and the 404 permit, and all of this took place. How would you trace sort of the momentum of the organization in terms of energy and enthusiasm over this sort of 10-year period? I mean, do you think it went up and down? Or sort of
up and down, very much. The, of course, we knew it was going to fight itself out Well, I guess we saw two fronts to the fight. One was the legal front, and we were going to fight out things in court. But we also saw a public opinion front. And if we could convince a lot of the people in Chapel Hill that Cane Creek was a bad choice, that we might then put enough pressure on elected officials so that they would in turn pressure Owosso into going for one of the other alternatives. So we had a sort of a two-pronged approach. The first legal thing that we attempted was the fact that Owosso wanted to get surveyors in, which required then people coming onto private land, and we went to court using a couple of guys who were living in the neighborhood at that time. We were young lawyers, partners, had a little law firm up in Graham, I believe. And so we started that one fairly early on. I think eventually lost that, and but it did postpone things. That Owosso couldn't get its surveyors on the land while that thing was in court.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that must have generated enthusiasm of people, the idea of people coming on your land.
Yeah, that showed that we had a little muscle and we could keep them off for a while. It was discouraging to have lost that one because we thought that we had a chance of winning on that one. And I guess for all the legal battles, we always figured we were the underdog. Little David's fighting against Goliath, but, you know, hell, David won. Mm-hmm. So we figured maybe we would just zing them between the eyes one time, and, you know, one good zing, and we thought we might win it. So, and there were a lot of opportunities. The environmental impact statement required a hearing and so on, and then the state required something that involved a hearing, and so there were a number of battlefields that we could make a stand on, and we did pretty well overall.
Mm-hmm. Would it be like, just before one of these hearings, would you kind of muster up support and get going, and then after the hearing kind of level out again, or I'm just trying to get a sense of how it felt over this period of time.
Indeed, it was like that. Preparing for one of these things, it was pretty much a small number of us meeting with the lawyers. Mm-hmm. We would do what we could to provide the materials for the lawyers. The more we could do than at zero cost, and the less our bills were to the lawyers. And then as some event would come up, then we would try to beat the bushes to get local people to go and just sit there in the audience to observe and to make their presence known. The lawyers encourage us to do that. They say that these things do have effects on people who have to make decisions, like to see a room full of concerned citizens. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes these decisions would go for us, and sometimes they would go against us, and sometimes they would be just totally ambiguous. Mm-hmm. So we took heart from the victories and tried to bear up under the defeats and so on. And yes, it was a problem keeping community interest and enthusiasm and morale up sometimes.
Uh-huh. Would you say particularly after you lost?
Yeah, particularly. Some people would say, well, that's it. That's the old ball game. Uh-huh. And then we have to say, but look, that's just one inning and we've got to play a whole game here. Uh-huh.
Well, would you say that there was kind of a gradual kind of dropping off of community support as time went on, that more and more people got tired, or is that not a good way to describe how it went?
Well, maybe a little bit, but I guess I thought it was remarkable how the community held on and held together. The crowning blow was when the people who owned the largest single chunk of land decided to settle with Owosso,
right.
Sell out. I think there was a general feeling throughout the community at that point that was it. That was like the keystone in the arch just suddenly dropping out, and then all the other stones people thought are just going to come tumbling down.
Mm-hmm. And you say, is that what happened? More?
Yeah, that's what happened. I think that there was still a legal battle or two left at that point, and I think Owosso had become a little shrill and desperate at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of doubts in the community and in Chapel Hill about whether it was really worth slugging it out with the Cane Creekers.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happened, well, that was a brilliant stroke on Owosso's part.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew that the Stanford family was in a precarious position.
Mm-hmm.
They knew of the health problems in the family, and they knew that there were no young Stanfords
mm-hmm.
coming along to take over the dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
And they just made an offer that few people could have resisted.
Right. Right. Well, one thing I'm interested in people mention Bill Stanford's health problems in these earlier interviews. They don't say he had cancer. At that point, did people in the community know that?
I didn't know it.
Yeah. I mean, he may not know by then. I'm just.
He may not have known either. I don't know. It was not until later that we heard that he had cancer and he was battling it, and eventually he succumbed to it. To us, it looked like that the major problem was that there were no children who really wanted to take it over.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that when he had inherited the place from his father, it was actually given in roughly equal shares to Bill and a number of brothers and sisters.
Right.
And Bill, in turn, had made agreements with all the others. So whenever he wanted to do something critical, which most farmers would have considered a private decision, he had to go to them
right.
and secure their legal permission to, say, buy some acres or build a barn or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
And that was, that he was in a bad position in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it was a very difficult kind of situation for that. Is that unusual? Do most of these farms around here, the other dairy farms, are they more or less owned by one or two people who are running it and like that? Or you may not know.
Well, I think the Tiers solved, or at least met that problem by incorporating.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a corporate entity there which owns the bulk of it.
Mm-hmm.
The Snipes, as far as I know, the major owners are James and Charles. I don't believe they've incorporated. And to tell the truth, I don't know what arrangements they've made for passing it on down
mm-hmm.
to the next generation. That's always a problem with big land holdings.
Mm-hmm.
If you chop them up too much, they become unviable.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you feel like you want to give everybody a roughly equal share, or else pay them for that, and that's tough to do.
That's a lot of money to pay.
Yeah.
Well, let me just kind of skip just up to the legal stuff for a little bit. I'm trying to fill in some holes. This is why
sure.
I kind of jump in. I jump all over the place. My impression from reading the transcripts and interviews and all this stuff is that really when you were fighting in court, particularly when you're fighting before the EMC, that things about cost and all of that were somewhat fuzzy in terms of what things were really going to cost. You know,
sure.
some people said once and this kind of thing. And that in a sense, the argument really came down to the community versus the quality of the water. It seems to me that that might have been the kind of crux issue. Does that seem reasonable to you, or do you think that it was?
That is not unreasonable.